Okay, I'm going to open this hearing for Tuesday, March 8th of the House Subcommittee on Higher Education. Welcome everyone to this committee meeting. We're going to be covering a number of topics. I want to apologize. I'm going to have to leave for a few minutes from the first one because I have to go testify in another committee. So it's my honor to turn the gavel over to my co-chair.
We have one right over here.
Oh, I got my own.
Wow.
How about that?
Yours is big? No.
And I'm ambidextrous, too. I can use my left hand, too.
Great.
Okay. We'd like to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3015. And we have some people that are here to testify on behalf of that. So would Walden Perkins please come forward and testify on behalf of House Bill 3015.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Walden Perkins, and I'm a father and a grandfather of past and present college students. I'm not here to say that Oregon colleges or universities and community colleges are unsafe. I'm here to ask for some bolstering of emergency plans from the state of Oregon. The bill, the Jean Clary Act, in 1986, Ms. Clary was a 19-year-old freshman at Lehigh University. She was murdered and raped in her dormitory room. Later on, when the family came in and the investigation was completed, they found that there had been 38 violent acts 3 years prior at Lehigh University on the campus, and the college hadn't done anything to advise the parents of other students or the students themselves that these crimes had occurred. So the students were basically unaware that there was potential of more violent crimes against them. Dean's folks, Connie and Howard, they got other crime victims together. They petitioned Congress, and they got the Jean Clary Disclosure Campus Security Policy and Campus Crime Statistics Law passed. Under that federal law, public or private colleges, including any post-secondary school, they must report crime statistics specific to their institution. They must distribute an annual security report to each and every student and employee. And in that, it must contain the crime statistics for their campus, describe the institution's policies and procedures concerning security and emergency notification and response, and it must be available for any future student applicant or future employee if they request it. They must have annual emergency response drills involving the local emergency services now. They must publicize and publicly critique the outcomes of those drills, good or bad. I'm hoping House Bill 3015 will encourage the Oregon Department of Education, the Oregon State Board of Higher Education, the Oregon University System, and the Office of Emergency Management to become actively involved in ensuring our institutions comply with the federal law. I won't go into the federal law today. It's too big and too extensive. This is just the handbook of Clary Act compliance that colleges should have and should be complying. I submitted to you, and hopefully you have a copy of a 13-page checklist of everything that the colleges have to do to comply with Clary, including administrative policies and procedures. This law is not about just about crime reporting. It's about emergency management. It's about crime prevention, education. And it's there to inform the students the safety that they need, their safety precautions they need to protect themselves while attending a college. It also is a tool for parents to use to determine if they feel that college is safe for their child, their grandchild, their relative to go to school there, or if there's some sort of special protection that they need to have that child take care of. Our colleges are very safe. We have one of the lowest crime rates in the United States that I've been able to determine through the review of statistics. We don't have major crime on our campuses. Major colleges, major incidents. We have major college incidents, but we have minor incidents. We only have one or two a year. We don't have the 30 or 40 assaults and rapes and murders that other colleges have. But I'm not here to talk about that. I'm talking about the critical incidents that could occur beyond crime. The chemical spills, the hazmat spills, the fires, the earthquakes. If you're an institution, you should be concerned about if it's going to happen. You should be concerned about when it's going to happen. Those colleges need to have emergency plans in place that are going to protect those students so that they, the colleges themselves, know how to react while they're waiting for the emergency services to arrive. If emergency services, if they're outside the community or out of the city district and into county, emergency services could be from a rural fire department that has to wait 15 minutes to get everybody into the station before they can even proceed to the scene of the incident. So these things have to be taken into consideration when the colleges implement their emergency plans. They have to make those plans specific to their organization. I believe it's grossly unfair if we have colleges that violate Clery, because Clery violations are severe in their punishment. The punishments are $27,500 per violation. That means each article in that 13-page checklist, if you don't comply with that, that's a $27,500 fine. But more importantly, the U.S. Department of Education can take that much and more, or completely revoke any and all student financial aid going to that institution. So if a college is fined $500,000 for violation of Clery, they can lose the same amount in federal funding for student aid. It doesn't affect the colleges. They'll pay off their portion of that $500 fine or $500,000 fine. But if they lose $500,000 in federal student aid, that's a serious hit to the students themselves. And that's where my concern lies. Two reasons I'm here today. One is to get the emergency plans up to date, get the colleges on board to respond properly to emergencies other than crimes on campus, and to protect our student aid. My daughter, my granddaughter, my even younger ones, I want them to go to college. I grew up in Southern Oregon. I knew for a fact that I was going to be a logger or I was going to work in the woods. I chose to join the military and use the GI Bill. But a lot of people out there, they don't have that opportunity anymore because of a mistake they may have made when they was a juvenile. The military is not even going to talk to them. The timbistry in Oregon as we knew it when I was a child is gone, never to return. Not just our kids, but now our people who have been laid off are going back to school. They need that federal aid, not just to buy class or to buy their books or to attend class. Some of them use it to support their families on. It's not an easy life out there, guys, when you don't have student aid. I watch it every day. I'm in the higher education field now, and I see it every day when a student loses part of the student aid because of misconduct on their part or whatever. It can be devastating. That's enough of that. I'm here to answer any questions you may have. So I've submitted all my paperwork. I encourage you to read it. Ask me any questions you want, and I'll give you an answer. If I can't, I'll find somebody who can.
Thank you. Are there any questions for our witness on the security, safety, emergency plans, all the above of our institutions, campuses? Rep. Parker, you're processing data?
Processing, yes. Okay. Stuff on the campuses with which I am not familiar. So thanks for bringing this to our attention. How do you interact with this in your role in higher ed? You said in the beginning, as I was trying to get this stuff up and look at the documents online, you said a couple of things that I missed. But your position in higher ed right now?
I'm a senior public safety officer.
Okay. All right. So you are very much right in the middle of this.
Well, I'll back that up, give you a background. I have 30 years' experience in law enforcement and emergency services, 12 of which has been with higher education.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks.
Mr. Perkins, do you think your experiences at your institution, maybe what you've witnessed or what you've seen, are giving you the impetus to try to impose this, let's say, on the entire system? Or from your knowledge, would you say that what you're referring to, your concerns apply to the various community colleges around the state?
In July, I attended what is called Advanced Clery Training in Seattle, Washington. During that meeting, there was a lot of folks who were from Washington, Oregon, California, Idaho, and Nevada who were attending that same one. Based on the information we received, based on the moans and groans of the people when they were told this information, it led me to believe that because of the law's complexity, colleges may not be intentionally violating this law. But because of complexity, they're not able to comply with it fully. One of the things that I'm trying to do with this bill is to bring in the state departments to ensure that every college is adhering to that checklist. And they're doing it the way it's supposed to be done to protect our students and our student aid. We don't have a lot of funding left, folks. It's going downhill in a hurry. You deal with that every day. And without student aid, some of our folks are going to have to drop out of college. Colleges shouldn't count on an audit from DOE to require them to get in compliance with Clery. It's a federal law. It's already required. But they take a chance each year if they don't go through this checklist and they don't verify everything's right, because it's only going to take one complaint or one incident that could bring an audit down from the U.S. Department of Education. As one fellow explained it to me, a visit from the Department of Education is like a visit from the IRS. An audit from the IRS. They will help you to correct mistakes in the future, but they will hang you for the ones you made in the past. And I don't want to see colleges happen that way, especially private institutions and community colleges. Can I answer your question? Thank you, sir.
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, that prompted a question, and I'm going through this. Would this apply to private schools also?
Any school in the state of Oregon, college, university, or post-secondary education, if they take any kind of federal funding, such as Pell Grants, okay. Perkins loans, anything like that, they're subject to this Clery law.
Okay. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at this, and it says that prior to July 1st of every calendar year, they have to do a compliance. And if there is a deficiency, they must cure that deficiency within a year. Mm-hmm. What happens if that does not happen?
I wanted to put some consequences in it. I did not draft that in there. I believe that would be up to the legislature. If they decide they want to put some sort of consequences in there, that's their business. That's what we voted GN for.
What would be your recommendation?
My recommendation would be, thank you for asking that, Representative Lindsay, because I was hoping somebody would. My recommendation is that a fine be adjudged against their state funding that is equivalent to the $27,500 that the feds would fine them, and then hold that out of their state funding until such time as they get into compliance.
And who would be the arbiter of that punishment?
That, again, I would not even try and venture. If I had my way about it personally, the Oregon Department or Oregon Attorney General, because of the fact that it's a violation of the law. Now, because we have so many various, we have Department of the Department of Education, we have Oregon University System, we had the board, we need to have it centralized at one spot.
Mr. Perkins, what's your understanding of institutions outside of Oregon and across the country that are either adhering to the law or perhaps are finding themselves?
State of New York has a Clery Act law. Okay. On their books that requires them to adhere to Clery, and they follow up on that. State of Pennsylvania has the same thing. State of California went through and audited a certain amount of their colleges or community colleges in this case, and found that 6 out of 10 were not in compliance. So they knew that they went back to the board, whoever it was in California, and said, these people got to get back in compliance. because we're playing with our federal funding and our student aid. So there are, every state is going through this process. And the unfortunate part about it is that it only takes one audit, and it could be devastating, financially devastating to a college, depending on how many violations they may find. Eastern Washington University, they had an audit that cost them a few dollars. Virginia Tech is still waiting to hear how much it's going to cost them. Eastern Michigan University was fined $375,000. The Paul Smith Arts and Sciences in New York was fined $250,000.
Okay. Any other questions? Bob Brown would like to come up. I'll excuse you. Thank you, Mr. Tree, for your time. Bob Brown, please. And Jack Rogers is with him. Thanks for coming up, gentlemen. Rep. Denver, would you like to take over the gavel?
Sure.
Okay. Know which ones from OSU.
If they're under
this is Bob Brown, and I'm Jack Rogers, the Director of Public Safety at Oregon State. Bob is our program representative for the Clery program at Oregon State University.
Great. Okay, whoever would like to speak first, go ahead.
Well,
introduce yourself by name, please.
Yes, sir. Again, my name is Jack Rogers. I'm the Director of Public Safety at Oregon State University. And we've been invited to come before you today as your committee examines House Bill, the proposal for House Bill 3015, to share with you information about Clery and how it applies to Oregon State University system, universities such as Oregon State University. We've taken the liberty of putting a couple of handouts together. We have an overview of the actual act itself, if we could share that with you, and then we have some talking points, and we'd like to give you a brief walkthrough about what Clery is all about and how it relates to Oregon State University and how we apply it and how we maintain and comply within the laws set forth through the Clery Act to comply with the DOA, the Department of Education requirements. So at that time, Bob Brown, I'd like to ask my colleague Bob Brown to start in and talk to you, give you an overview of Clery, and then at any point in time we can stop and answer questions and add clarification.
Okay. So colleagues, if you have questions, let's just shoot them at the gentleman, and let's look for about 5 or 10 minutes for the total. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the chance to speak today. My name is Robert Brown. I'm the program coordinator for Clery Act at Oregon State University. General reporting requirements for the Clery Act, as the previous speaker mentioned, is crime statistics, which I believe you have a paper with kind of blue text on it or blue printing.
It's
that
coming.
Is an example of our Clery statistical report for last year. We are also required to provide roughly 24 policies, procedures, or program statements which demonstrate or define how Oregon State University will respond to various situations occurring on campus. They range from things like emergency response to a crime occurring at the present time, timely warnings, which are a way of notifying the community of problems that are considered to be ongoing, and would have a potential to affect the students, faculty, or staff. These policies also cover things like the procedures for sexual offenders to be registered, how students can get that information. It's pretty broad. The report, as of about 3 years ago, could be contained in a document of just several pages. This is one copy of the report as it is right now, so it's exploded in the last couple years with new requirements for fire safety, response procedures for missing students who live on campus, and so on. We have an annual fire report, which I just mentioned. It includes a fire log, which would allow the students to look at any incident that has occurred in the dorms for a fire, similar to an activity log or a daily log for the state police. It has evacuation procedures for each residence hall so that students are properly trained in how to get out of the building in case of an emergency. It has records for training so that we can document that we have taken proactive steps to inform the students about safe procedures. It has reporting requirements, which is just a statement that says if you see a fire or if you observe a crime, here are the people to whom you should report it, and to ensure that that information is not only communicated to emergency management personnel, but also ends up being included in the annual report. We're also in the fire safety portion required to list areas of improvement that we intend to do in the residence halls, in the event many of the buildings are older and systems needed to be upgraded. And they're trying to inform parents and students, this is the condition of the building at present, and here's where we're going with it, so they can make a decision as to whether or not that's where they want to house their son or daughter. Daily requirements for Cleary involve a daily log of all reported crimes or incidents occurring on campus. And that document has to be available for the previous 60 days on the spot. In other words, someone walks up and says they want to see it, we have to provide it right at that moment. And for anything over 60 days old, we have 2 days to produce a document. As the previous speaker mentioned, we have timely warnings and emergency notifications. If a crime is occurring with some regularity on campus and it continues to be a problem, we are required by Cleary to issue a timely warning for any Cleary Act reportable crime. For example, if we had a situation of burglary that's going on and we get several reports in a short period of time, we would send out a timely warning to inform the students and faculty, staff, that they need to be exercising greater caution. An emergency notification is similar to a timely warning, but is broader. Emergency notification would include incidents that are not covered under the Cleary list of crimes, but perhaps a chemical spill, a natural disaster, something that is occurring right now and must be dealt with immediately. So we put out emergency notification to the campus community and get that information out. The challenge that we have is that the timely warning and emergency notification have a rather loose definition in terms of how fast it has to be communicated. It can be problematic to get a communication out that contains important information within a brief period of time. As an example, a few weeks ago, OSU distributed a timely warning for computer thefts that were occurring around campus, and I was tasked with putting together the document that was sent out. And it takes roughly an hour to do that. From recent experience at Virginia Tech, that type of a timeline would not be acceptable because of the severity of the situation. And you're aware that communication that you want to put out, you want it to be trustworthy, reliable, have some specific content, that is very difficult to do in a short amount of time.
Mr. Brand, this is very useful information, I have to say. We're going to have to bring it to a close, though.
Okay. The only other part about Cleary that is a challenge for us is record keeping. Everything has to be documented and kept for 7 years. Are there any questions of me?
Committee?
I have...
Rep Springer. And then Rep Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just magic flower, you
just
all.
Yes, we should report that.
Moving right along. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. And
I guess my question is, how do you work with OSP on this? Because they certainly have to have a role in this, and so I'm wondering how that's done in conjunction.
Representative Springer, I'd like to address that quick question. As most of you know, we have a state police operation on campus. They are the law enforcement service providers for Oregon State University by contract with Oregon State University. We're in the same office, we're in the same squad room, the same building. When we have any type of an emergency situation, we will immediately utilize our emergency notification system that we have in place. It's through Blackboard Connect Ed, vendor from Southern California, and it is a very fine-tuned program so that we can immediately craft an emergency notification message, whether it's an active shooter, chemical spill, fire, gas leak, that type of thing, and we can place that message into the system, push the magic button, if you will, and everyone who has signed up to receive the messages will automatically receive those messages. The system allows for up to 6 phone numbers, 2 email addresses, and 1 SIMS text message address, and naturally, we encourage all students, staff, and faculty at Oregon State to access that. Students are automatically included in the program at no expense to them through their ONID email address systems, and all they have to do is go in to the portal and they can add the additional phone numbers, and in most cases parents want their numbers into that system too, so they know what's going on. We have a very tight-knit operation at Oregon State University. We are very proud of the law enforcement service provision that is provided for the university through the state police, and share information and work on a collaborative basis on a daily basis so that everyone knows what's going on, and we have distinct relationships with all of the different departments on campus, whether student health, counseling, psychological services, you name it, we have partnerships with them so that we can get the message out.
Thank you. Rep Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for my previous violent action. This is a couple of areas to think about in the bill. Rep Springer asked before about the for-profit colleges, and we don't, as the bill is currently drafted, we've got 2 sections. One is community colleges and one is state institutions of higher ed. Neither of those include these for-profit institutions. I'm looking at a summary of the Clery Act online, and it says all public and private institutions of post-secondary education. So I think that suggests that those other organizations are indeed covered, the for-profit institutions, and nodding heads suggest that that's correct. So if we need this House bill, and it's not clear to me that we do in light of the Clery Act, we should probably tweak that, all right? The other question, follow-up, if I may.
Yes,
the other question, and feel free to chime in as appropriate,
yes.
The other question I have is about the dates, required dates for these reports, because the Clery Act has the requirement of submitting one, I don't have it in front of me right now, by October 1st reports, right? And the bill talks about maybe July 1st. We don't want to make additional work for anyone, right? So is there a way to, if we go down this path, just have the folks prepare the reports that are required and we get a copy gets sent to our Department of Education, et cetera?
Well, it makes sense for us to bring whatever we're doing into alignment with the federal system. But I guess I would throw out the question to you two gentlemen. First of all, if you think that this state bill is necessary from your perspective.
I think that the bill, if the law states that all institutions of education should receive the benefit of the Clery Act and the reporting and the notification requirements, and I think in that perspective, I'd say yes, because to distinguish between a private school or a community college and a large institution such as Oregon State, if you're a parent, like Mr. Barker said, I believe that was it.
Perkins.
Okay. If you're a parent, you want your child or grandchild to receive the same umbrella of safety, whether they go to a private institution, community college, or a state institution. As far as the reporting requirements, I note that the proposal is for July 1. As an example, Oregon State University, if this thing were to pass, we would volunteer to offer our services to educate the private and community colleges the background and integral workings of Clery so that they can come up to speed. This is not an easy act to learn overnight. It takes Bob spends hours and hours each week just trying to keep up with the requirements of compliance. So if this were to pass and come about, one of the things, the July 1 date, we're thinking the federal date says October 1. Why would we have two dates? We would want to get that and keep it, I think, in line with what the federal requirements are, so not to generate extra work for all of the employees that have to generate and offer those numbers in and lock those numbers in. So again, if this were to pass, I think it would be part of our responsibility in the larger institutions to grab the smaller institutions by the hand, help educate them, help them understand the workings of the Clery Act, and help them get underway, because it's not an easy job.
Thank you. Rep. Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And frankly, I'm sitting here a little confused. So we currently have the Clery Act federally that tells us we will do these things. Okay. And that act, as the violent but good Harker. Representative Harker just pointed out, includes community colleges and any college that receives federal dollars. So then this is occurring right now, and so I'm trying to figure out what this bill is doing that we're not doing, or if it's clarifying something. And I realize there's a couple, the dates don't mesh, but is this clarifying something we need clarified?
One thing...
Before you hit me, go ahead.
May I?
Sure.
I think that the Clery Act is saying the reports need to be submitted to the U.S. Department of Education, and I believe that the bill,
right.
House bill says
Department
to the
Ed.
State Department of Ed, correct?
I'm sorry.
I think that's the only difference that I'm seeing, aside from the dates, which seem to be an undesirable difference.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is a significant difference, though. Yes, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding in reading Senate Bill 3015 was that it was asking me to verify or present information that proved I was in compliance with Clery, which is a different question to me. It's one thing to present the Clery data and report, and it's another thing to look at it and say, oh, am I in compliance? Because it is a complex law, and the Department of Ed, in many ways, has remained somewhat ambiguous about defining things in the specific terms. For example, they don't tell us what the report should look like. They just say what it must contain. They don't say what a timely amount, what a reasonable amount of time is for a timely warning. They're just going to come in and tell us during an audit whether we met the requirement. So I really don't know how I would present to you information that says, yes, I'm in compliance. I mean, I know what the data is, and I can put the data in there. But whether the Department of Ed looks at that data and agrees with me is beyond my control. I don't know how to do that.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for appearing, and I think we have a couple of other people in the audience to hear from.
Thank you for your time.
We may need to come back to you for some further information, so if you could just stick around, that would be great. Thank you. Okay, I call up Emma Calloway from the Oregon Student Association, Karen Smith from OCCA. Thank you. Okay, Emma, would you like to start? Give us your perspective on this.
Sure, no problem. For the record, my name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association. I wanted to share with you our perspective from our students today, but also I'm going to bring forward some of my own personal experience as well around this particular issue. So we believe that students are more successful and when they feel safe and are aware of the dynamics around their surroundings. At this time, students have expressed the importance of this bill and unanimously have supported 3015. We believe, though, that we understand based on previous testimony that we wouldn't want to create any additional work or additional costs, and we do believe that the majority of our institutions are compliant with the Clery Act, but we also think that it's important to give this information over to the State Department, and I'd also love to see if if 242 was to go through and we have a coordinating commission or any of these other higher education ideas, that the information from the Clery Act be given directly to those institutions or those coordinating bodies, because I think that that would help create a sense of ownership around these particular issues. So students need the ability to go to the library. They need the ability to walk to a study session after dark, take classes, take night classes, etc. Students have non-traditional lifestyles, and we need to do everything we can to accommodate students in regards to their safety on campus of all hours of day and night, and I think we probably are all on the same page there. We believe that this bill does two things. It first publicizes the safety of our campuses so students can take the necessary precautions as they move through a new community and navigate a non-traditional lifestyle. This bill also encourages campuses to assess their own climate and student safety, and also potentially the coordinating bodies as well. We understand that some people may have concern with this bill in light of and concerns with this bill around bringing problems to light that we don't have the budget to fix. And OSA understands that most of our institutions don't have the budget to maybe update all of their lighting concerns or chain, you know, pick some really costly way to fix this problem. But there are other cost-cutting measures that can improve the safety of a campus. When I was a resident assistant at the University of Oregon, I walked many students to the hospital after dark because a cab and often police officers in an area can't legally take you if you're very, very sick. Unfortunately, I've also helped many students who were victims of sexual assault when I was an RA and when I was student body president at the University of Oregon. And this is a problem on every campus. The close living quarters and of post-secondary education campuses are more likely to have victims and perpetrators of sexual assault living and working close together. This issue is close to a lot of students, and they asked me to bring forward the statistics of at least 1 in 4 college women will be victims of sexual assault during their time on campus, and more than 70% of rape victims knew their attackers, compared to half of all other violent crimes. So this is a real issue that that is, you know, part of our college experience. These are some of the reasons that college campuses are more prone to issues around sexual assault. We know that increasing campus police isn't always the answer. We need supportive programs and trainings and real creative solutions to fixing this problem. We also know that odd things like cutting down excessive shrubbery and changing light from yellow light to white light can help people see their attackers more clearly at night, and that's especially important if people know their attackers, they're able to confront these issues more quickly. There are amazing benefits to making students aware of the climate that they're living in and helping give them the information they need to keep themselves safe. This bill can also place positive pressure on institutions to find low-cost ways of responding to crime on campus. With this bill, we will have real public statistics at our disposal, and hopefully the State Board of Education will be readily given those statistics and that information as opposed to just the federal government. Education truly is a bipartisan issue this session, and we really appreciate all the authors that are bringing forward ideas about creative solutions to helping create our campuses more safe. And I'm happy to answer any questions, as this is an issue I worked on personally when I was a student in my own life, and also with any role I held at the University of Oregon campus. So just wanted to bring that forward with you today.
Thank you, Emma. Anybody have any quick questions about Emma? Okay, why don't we move on to Karen, and then we'll see if we have further questions. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Smith, and I'm the general counsel of the Oregon Community College Association. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today with some concerns that we have about this bill in particular, because we believe it is unnecessary and does duplicate some very stringent requirements under the federal law, both the Clery Act and also the Higher Education Act, which was just reauthorized in 2008, and additional requirements regarding campus safety and crime statistics were added in that 2008 reauthorization. That 300-page handbook that was alluded to earlier was just recently published by the U.S. Department of Education as guidance to institutions who fall under the Clery Act requirements to help them sort through the complexities of the law and ensure compliance with the law. This is a law that is administered by the U.S. Department of Education. It is a top priority of theirs, as it is with ours, to ensure that our community colleges are in compliance with the law. The Department of Ed does provide guidance to the colleges. It monitors that compliance. It investigates complaints about colleges and institutions that are not in compliance. And it does have two rather large sticks that have been referred to already, the civil fines that can be assessed per violation, as well as the loss of federal financial aid funds. Those are very serious issues to our colleges, and we're not wanting to put our students at risk in having unsafe campuses, but also in not losing those federal funds. So we have a great incentive to ensure that we are complying with the federal law.
Karen, can I just interrupt? When you say the Department of Ed, you're talking about the federal department.
I'm talking about the U.S. Department of
right.
Education, yes,
mm-hmm.
excuse me.
Yes.
Community colleges, you know, we have locally elected boards. We are under the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and our coordinating board is the State Board of Education, but we're not governed by the Oregon Department of Education, just to be clear about that.
Right, but just if I could follow up on that, I mean, I think part of the intent of this bill appears to be to have a state understanding of how the colleges and universities are performing in this area. So a desire to have the members of the State Board of Education be privy to this information for the colleges, and the Board of Higher Education privy to the information for the universities, presumably so that if any action needs to be taken, they're aware of it.
Right.
Currently, does the State Board of Education know the extent to which the colleges are adhering to the demands of the federal law?
Mr. Chair, we're not required to submit that information directly to the State Board of Education, but we are required to publish our annual Cleary reports on our websites, and we also enter that information into the U.S. Department of Education's web-based system, which is available online. Anyone can go onto their website and search by institution. They can also search by regions. So all of this information is publicly available now to anyone who wishes to see it. If there is a campus safety office on campus, the law requires you to maintain daily crime logs, and those logs are also available for public inspection. Current students and current employees have access to the information, as well as prospective students and prospective employees. That information has to be made available to them. The law doesn't state how that occurs, but most frequently the information is published in our catalogs. It's available online. It's also contained. Many community colleges do their quarterly class schedules, and the information is contained in there as well. So the information is readily available. We would have concerns about, as has been pointed out, that House Bill 3015 has a July 1 date to report, and the federal date is October 1. We also have concerns because neither the State Board of Education nor the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development currently has any expertise or staff that is expert in Cleary Act issues or Cleary Act enforcement, because that has been a U.S. Department of Education role. So there would be an issue with having to hire, as the bill is currently stated, where they would have to create a new report and then also find some way to evaluate noncompliance. That would require additional resources, and it would require additional resources on our campuses to be able to fulfill those new requirements. So I just want to leave with you that we are very committed to complying with the Cleary Act. I'm not aware of any Oregon Community College that is out of compliance with the Cleary Act, knowingly or willfully. Certainly, it is a very complex and complicated law that is evolving, and I've attended some training sessions through the National Association of Colleges and University Attorneys that just give a very broad view of the Cleary Act requirements, and it is incredibly complicated. So.
Okay, thank you,
thank
Karen.
You.
It's very helpful. Any questions, committee? Yes, Rep. Parker.
Thanks. Thanks for all of that information. That was very helpful. Do you or does OSA have any availability of this info on the websites already as just been described, does it seem that this bill that we're considering would make the information make it available in a more easy to search manner, or looking for where this isn't duplicative?
Yeah, I've co-chairs and Representative Parker, I absolutely agree that there's probably 99% of this bill that is already happening. We wanted to express, just in case there are any outliers out there that aren't within the OUS system or the community college system, because that's what we understand is in compliance, but I'm not sure what lies outside of that in terms of institutions that need to be better at this. And then the other aspect is that we believe that if this information went directly to the State Board of Education, that there would be another level of eyes and another level of pressure that would exist that you don't have when you need to when the information is passively presented to you. And we also believe that, it's my understanding that the community colleges make their, through what you just told me, Karen, through the website and other options, when a public records request has to be accessed in order to access this information, that does bother students because that is a more lengthy process and that is much less readily available than being on a website directly. And we've had problems with public record requests in the past when students have looked for information around crime statistics, things like that.
Yes, quickly.
Have you had those problems with public records requests since the Clery Act has come into existence and implementation?
Yes, with public records requests. I don't personally have enough information on whether that's a problem with the Clery Act, but with records requests in general. So if an institution came to you and said, this information is only available through a public records request, right, that's not enough for us. We feel like that's a very lengthy and arduous process.
Okay. Thank you very much, both of you. With that, I'm going to end this public hearing on House Bill 3015. We will deliberate and come back to it. Not today. I would like to, just as we're trying to manipulate the agenda here, we definitely wanted to do a work session on House Bill 2353, so we'd like to do that next. So I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2353. This is the bill dealing with the National Career Readiness Certificate. There were amendments, -1 and -2 amendments, that we approved last week. We were waiting for the fiscal, and Anna, can you tell us where we are on that?
House Bill 2353 is ready to move. The amendments have been combined, and the fiscal analysis maintains a minimal expenditure impact. So we are ready to move the bill.
Okay, then I would entertain a motion. Okay, Representative Johnson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would move that we move House Bill 2353, with the -2 amendments, as amended to the House Committee on Education, with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Johnson has moved adoption. Discussion. Rep. Lindsay, please.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I'd like to move for a 5-minute recess.
Okay, can we make it 3 minutes?
Sure.
Okay, we're standing in recess.
Sorry, Erica. Okay, I'm going to call this back into session. So we have a motion on the table to move the House Bill 2353 to the House to the Education Committee. Sorry, again, just for those of you who are in the audience, the National Career Readiness Certificate is a very exciting project that's been in the works for the last year or two, bringing together advocates for education and workforce development. The Oregon Workforce Investment Board has been involved with it, the State Board of Education, a number of different entities that will create a way for us to have our workforce applicants know where they stand in terms of their skills. They can be certified against a national norm as a bronze standard, gold standard, silver standard, gold standard, platinum standard, and of course in Oregon everyone is going to be platinum standard at some point. So with that, are there any questions or discussion items? If not, Erica, why don't you call the roll, please?
President
Parker?
Aye.
President Hoyle?
Aye.
President Luzzi?
Aye.
President
Springer?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Johnson?
Aye. Co-Chair Johnson? Aye. Okay, House Bill 2353 is moved to the House Education Committee. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2353. And I'm now going to open an informational meeting on Governor Kitzhaber's higher education policy. And I would call up Nancy Golden, who's the education advisor to the governor, and Duncan Wise, please, from the Oregon Business Council. And Duncan, it's a real pleasure. First time you've come before this committee. If you don't know Duncan, he's one of our great volunteer education advocates, longtime member of the State Board of Education, and instrumental in moving us down the road towards an enhanced Oregon diploma and making that line up with our colleges and universities. And I'm sure he'll have more to say about that. So, whoever wants to go first.
I'll begin. Co-Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden, the education advisor to Governor Kitzhaber, and I'm joined here by Duncan Wise, and he's already been introduced to you. Duncan, in addition to being the president of the Oregon Business Council, was the co-chair of the Higher Ed Transition Plan. Mary Spilde, the other co-chair of the Transition Committee, could not be here today since she is out of state. Duncan will be presenting on the Higher Education Transition Report and share how it's a critical part of the 0 to 20 seamless system of education proposed by the governor, and also how this plan influenced the budget. After his presentation, we'll both be available for questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Denbrough, for those remarks. He was an absolutely, your co-chair was an absolutely spectacular advisor to the Board of Education when he was representing the faculty, and it's really a pleasure to see you and all of you. What I would like to do is give you an overview of the work that Mary and I did, Mary Spilde and I did during the transition. It was really a pleasure to have this opportunity. Nancy and Ron Saxton co-chaired the K-12 piece of the work, and then Lynn Saxton and Pam Curtis did the early childhood work, and we really did it together. And again, that's a very important point. When the governor called us, he convened all of us at once and asked us to think about the whole education continuum, consistent with his vision of a 0 through 20 pipeline, to try to really understand where we need to be investing and how we can most effectively be investing and redesigning our education service delivery to get the most value of it out of it. Mary Spilde, I hope you have a chance to have her come before you at some point. She is one of the great resources we have in post-secondary. It was a real pleasure to work with her, and I learned a lot, and I really wish she were here. So what I'd like to
do is just give you an overview of what our conclusions were. This is, again, a report we presented to the governor before he presented the budget. So it's a little bit old now, and but I hope I can touch on some of the major policy issues we thought were important as we looked at the immediate budget, but I hope they also will touch on some of the issues that you may be confronting as you look at your work as you go down the road here. So I want to start with just the most obvious point, but I think it's an important place to start, the importance of post-secondary education to Oregon's future. We do believe, I certainly believe, that the whole education continuum is important. We need to have a strong set of services at every stage of education. And as we move into the post-secondary years, we know from a lot of the data that the education of young adults and adults to a high degree level, either an associate technical degree or four-year degree, is absolutely crucial for their own well-being. There's a strong connection between degrees and income, and it's also really important for the future of the economy. Much more important today than it was 30, 40 years ago. We know this is a really critical piece of the work we have to do, both for the individual's health in our state, but also for the economic health. So this is a big deal, the post-secondary investments, what your work involves. So that's observation one. The second observation is, again, one I think you're all too well aware of. Despite that, the dynamics of state budgeting and where we've been over the last decade, we've seen a tremendous disinvestment in post-secondary education. The numbers I've been going around the state sharing, again, the last year has been it's a 1% annual growth rate for the last 10 years for both community college and university investment, unadjusted for inflation, unadjusted for enrollment growth. We've had about a 45% decline per student in investment in post-secondary education in Oregon. And that, from a individual point of view, I think is a concern. It obviously has meant higher tuition. It's meant less access, and I think it's probably affected to some degree quality, although I would say we have incredibly innovative campuses that do their best with the dollars available. But it's been a real challenge in this last decade, and it's created a lot of stress in that environment. And we do have the unenviable position in Oregon where the generation entering the workforce, the 25-year-olds, are less well-educated than the generation leaving the workforce, which is, again, probably the first time in history we've had that happen. We've actually plateaued and declined a little bit. So this, again, is a very big deal, how you manage this issue and how you deal with the resource allocation. I would observe that we have extraordinarily innovative schools. I mentioned that already. But, again, if you take a look at some of the steps that have been taken in recent year, the career pathways work, the 2+2 work, the high school diploma that's connected with post-secondary that the chair mentioned, our investment in engineering, the capstone experiences we've seen in a number of campuses, the inclusion of research and undergraduate education. A lot of great work has gone on in post-secondary education we can be proud of. And again, the schools are doing a great job with the resources they have, but we are in a constrained environment. So the challenge that the governor gave us as we did our work was how do we take the dollars available, and he gave us a number, and it was a specific number. It was $1.331 billion for post-secondary. How do we use those dollars as effectively as we can to achieve the goals that we have in education? And I think that challenge that we faced, and we did our best in a short amount of time, is the challenge that we all face as we look at these dollars, we look at the policies associated with these dollars, and we do our work. As we did this, we were guided by some goals. The 40-40-20 goal you're familiar with, we want to increase access. We want to particularly serve Oregonians, low-income Oregonians, who might not have been served before. We want to make sure we have a solid progression of degree completion, students meeting degrees as fast as they can, and with as least amount of remedial education as we possibly can. So those are some of the goals that we established as we did that work. So we've pretty early on, then we took a look and asked the schools themselves what their challenges were. And again, I just stress the stress that they're under. In the community college case, about a 30% in growth in enrollment in the last 30 months. The dollar per student has dropped from about $2,500 to, I think it's $1,700 of state investment per student. Huge stress on that system. Similar story in the university system. Across the board, we're seeing a surge in enrollment with the economy declining and putting real stresses on those systems. So what do we do? How do we manage this? First of all, we thought it was important to focus what is the most important goal that we'll look at as we look at the allocation. And our conclusion, and again, you can debate it, but as you look at all the dollars that are available to the post-secondary arena, we thought the most important service was fundamentally undergraduate education, first 2 and 4 years to degree. We would point out there's a lot of other services that are provided in that broad post-secondary category, research, the Ag Extension Services, Ag Experiment Station, Forest Research, a whole series of statewide services, as well as professional and graduate programs. And those are all really, really important. But our conclusion was we've got to protect the core of undergraduate education at all to really create the pipeline we need for the future. And so we did prioritize that as best we could. The second thing we wanted to prioritize was need-based aid for those who couldn't afford the tuition. We know tuition is going to have to rise given the lack of state-level investment that's going to be available. You can argue how much, but that's just the result when we don't invest across the board in this service. And so we really said it was very important to look at the need-based aid. As you're probably aware, the Oregon Opportunity Grant funding dropped. It just was basically spent all in the first year of the biennium. We have a huge problem with need-based aid in Oregon. And so we recommended that despite the general decline in revenues available, we ought to actually put more money in that because that's a key priority. So we actually, you'll see in the governor's budget, I think it's one of the few areas, but there's a bit of growth was in the Oregon Opportunity Grant recommendation. So we really focused on that, and frankly, by doing that, some things will not get as much funding, and again, I mentioned a number of them. We really thought it was important, though, to take a hard look at where the dollars go and try to prioritize among them. We tried to keep all the programs pretty much, in intact. We didn't cut anything directly, but we certainly, as we made choices, tried to make recommendations towards undergraduate education. Then the final thing that the governor asked us to do, and this is, again, I think surfacing some of the work ahead for you, was to say, okay, this is the amount of money we have. Down the road, there may be more resources. We hope there are, but there probably won't be many more this biennium. How do we look at the design of the system to make it more productive within the level of resources we have? What can we do differently to make this system work better in the future? And we came up with a set of ideas, and I think they begin to surface some of the policy issues that will be in front of you this session and beyond, and I think start to set an agenda for how we get greater value for the dollars that are available. The first thing we recommended was to really continue the work we've been doing on the high school community college higher ed connection. We need to move students through the system, meeting proficiencies all the way along so we have less remediation. And the work we've been doing in our state in articulating curriculum, aligning the high school diploma requirements with post-secondary is incredibly important for improving the productivity of the post-secondary and the K-12 system. We spend a lot of money in remedial education. Talk to any university professor, community college professor, they will tell you they don't like to have to reteach classes that should have been done in high school. So one of the values of the high school diploma, where we have reading, writing, and math standards at a pretty high level, should over time help the universities and community colleges avoid the need for remediation. The area that Mary helped me understand was the remedial classes in the community college system are not necessarily as productive as they need to be. We have too many students churning through those programs, not getting the value. One of the things she recommended to the team was a hard look at how we do remedial education in the community colleges and taking a fresh look at that.
Could I just interrupt you? Rep Parker, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, please.
How is it that people are admitted, apparently in significant numbers, into these institutions when they don't meet the base criteria?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parker, it's about standards, and it's about not knowing, frankly. I mean, there are two different systems, of course, community college and the universities.
Right.
Community college systems start with the community college is an open enrollment system, so you can attend.
Right, but we're talking about the universities.
And the universities right now, they currently do not, in theory, have remedial classes, but the faculty will still tell you that there are deficiencies. So the way to get at that, I believe, is to have clear high school graduation standards and clear demonstration of mastery. The grades alone do not give enough indication for the universities to really know whether students are ready. Too many students with good grades aren't able to meet, you know, aren't meeting what a lot of faculty would say their needs are in math, writing, and reading. So that's the reality of the current system. What we're really proud and thrilled with what the university has now done is to say we're going to really focus on the new high school requirements, that is, demonstrated proficiency in reading, writing, and math, so that which they believe, and I certainly believe, will be a better indicator of whether students actually are ready. But it's a great question, and it's a key part of the design work we need to do. Is we design the whole pre-K 20 system, if we build them around standards and make sure that students meet the standards all the way along the way, we're going to have a lot more productive system, and we won't have so much remediation going on. But the reality is, we do.
Follow up?
Thanks. Okay. Perhaps an uncomfortable question, not for you, but for the entire state. Do we know if Oregon students from Oregon secondary institutions admitted into the Oregon University system spend time in these remedial classes more than people from other states? Because the answer that you gave focuses on our production mm-hmm. of high school people. It doesn't focus on the criteria used mm-hmm. to admit those people.
Correct. Representative Harker, I don't have an answer. Would not expect Oregon is all that different. This is a national problem. It's identified nationally. I think most states are grappling with this issue. It's really about the future of high school. One thing I would just say for this committee, one of the wisest people on post-secondary education, Pat Callen, when he came in front of a group of us, especially the Center for Higher Ed Policy, said, if you really care about higher ed, you've got to focus on the high school. Because the high school is the gateway, and if you don't have the skills, there's just way too much remediation, and what you want are graduates that are really ready to take advantage of that learning. And again, it's a much bigger issue in the community college system. And so, again, this pipeline and creating the right pipeline and having accountability to results is extremely important for improving the productivity. I think many of us believe it's the one most important thing you can do to improve the productivity of education. Move students hitting standards so they move along. And again, I've talked with the co-chair about this, who is a language teacher, and I think he would concur. It's a big deal. I mean, it's a very big deal to make sure that we're meeting the standards.
It is very much so, and I can say that all the states are wrestling with this yes. problem, as they are with the general problem of remediation, which is something that I'm hoping that this committee, when we have more time at our disposal, will come back to and really do some probing on. But Rep. Lindsay has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. You just mentioned, Duncan, the increase in needs-based aid, and I've heard that over and over and over again. And I'm a fan of needs-based aid. I'm a beneficiary of needs-based aid. I was a recipient of the Pell Grant, and it helped me get through. I also worked several hours a week mm-hmm. all through school. My question is one thing that has not been addressed anywhere is what are we doing to help keep down the costs, specifically to help what I call the middle crew.
Mm-hmm.
You got the more of the wealthies,
mm-hmm.
you got needs based that are usually covered, but you got people, which is now me,
right.
that I'm saving like crazy for my daughter's education, 529s, but I'm scared to death I won't be able to afford that, and they won't be able to qualify my daughters for needs based, but I'm not in a position to pay everything. So that's one major concern that I'd like to see fully addressed. And in addressing it, one thing that I'm very concerned of is that we need to make sure that in needs base, etc., that we need to send the message it's all right to work during school. It's all right to eat ramen soup mm-hmm. during school. It's all right to have a hard time and struggle through school, because that's one of the major educations that I received was becoming independent
mm-hmm.
and learning to work to sustain myself. So in answering that question, I'd like to see what thought processes are going on in your crew to address that.
Co-Chair Dembro, Representative Lindsay, great question, and I think you're actually highlighting the second area we thought very important to work on going forward. There is not a clear policy framework for the combined investment in universities, community college, and need-based aid that should have, I think, the goal. I think our goal fundamentally should be, if we want 80% of Oregonians to have a two- or four-year degree. The goal should be every Oregonian should have financial access to post-secondary education. That should be the goal. It needs to be the goal. The Oregon Opportunity Grant was incredibly well designed. It was, I mean, it's viewed as a national model because it has a sliding scale design, so based on income. So you get pretty high levels of income. If you fully implemented, you would be able to access it. And it also includes family contributions and work. It is in the design of the model. So it basically adds the Pell Grants plus the Oregon Opportunity Grant, assumes work, assumes some family contribution where it's possible. And so it's incredibly well designed. It's just, I believe now to fund it fully at the current tuition rates, I forget the number, it would be on the order of $300 to $400 million. But conceptually, that's where we ought to go. And so what we recommended, what both Mary and I observed, and I have been noticing this for a long time, is what you have now are three different budgets, even four if you consider the high school, university, community college, and need-based aid. They're all separate budgets in front of your committee, Representative Springer, and they're not connected. They need to be connected in a context so that we can say, with the goal in mind, what is the base support plus need-based aid, and given the tuition level established, that would allow your kids to go to school at whatever income level you're at. That should be the goal, and we do not have a policy framework to do that right now. It's the best case I can make for the Oregon Education Investment Board. An Oregon Education Investment Board would do that. You'd have that framework in this committee and in the Ways and Means Committee, so you would really know whether you could go. And then we need to figure out a way to fund it on a permanent basis so that you have some predictability, because that's the other piece. We need to be able to tell a sixth grader, you know, the parent of a sixth grader, that you are going to be able to go to college. We need to have that as a part of the structure for where we need to go. So we observed, and I guess this is a way of hitting a point I was going to make anyway, but again, the other area we recommended, you know, along with focusing on the continuum and improving the productivity of the continuum, is to get a more rational basis to do exactly what you're talking about. And again, I'd encourage you to look at the Opportunity Grant. I think it was really well done. I wasn't involved in it, but I was a great admirer of it.
Yes. Thank you, Duncan. This might be a good time for us to shift over to talking about the investment board. Mm-hmm. I think we're all going to be wrestling with mm-hmm. this question of the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, the investment board, how all this is going to fit together. I do. Before we get into that, though, I just do want to say to Rep. Lindsay that, in my experience at the community colleges, it is very rare that you have a student who's not working as they're going to college. I would say at least 95% of my students are currently working, and often at very significant levels while they're in school. So it's pretty common. Mm-hmm. So I don't know who wants to start off talking about it, Nancy or Duncan, the investment board and where the governor's head is right now.
I could begin, and I think what's critical even to this conversation is the 0 through 20 nature of it, because, as I was hearing Duncan talk, one thing going through my head is, which I thought might be going through your head, is, so where's all that money come from to, at the other end, create access for every Oregon student who's ready to go on to community college or higher ed institutions? And I think the answer is, if you really look at 0 to 5, and if students came to kindergarten with the skills to be successful, and if they could read at the end of first grade, you could reinvest all that money that went into remediation for the things we want to get at, which is like access to higher ed, because we know how critical that is so people can really earn the kind of wages they need to survive and contribute and all of those things. So, it really looks at all, it assumes a system, like the outcome at the end of high school is that every student graduates without the need for remediation. Now, that would take care of the question of why are all the kids getting into community college when they don't have the skills to be in community college. So you kind of have to look at the whole system and really to understand how you can do reinvestment, because what the governor is saying is if it's a seamless system, then there will be dollars to reinvest in the things we really need to reinvest in to have all our students graduate and meet the 40-40-20 goals and also be able to contribute as community members, kind of like Representative Lindsay, I heard you kind of talking about, just working, contributing, getting educated at the same time. So it's about looking at those bigger questions. And when you raise the question to the highest level, you know, now we talk about OSAC and all those things. The bigger question is access. How do we create access? And it might mean with existing systems, or it might mean with different systems, but it's really creating, you know, a system that really gets us to the outcomes that we want. So it's looking at what are the outcomes, you know, what are the standards, how do we measure if we're meeting the standards, and as we invest our dollars, how do we invest them in the key leverage points that are really going to get us to whatever the outcomes we're looking for. So I know one of the reasons the co-chairs think the first year of community college or four-year college is so important, because we know there's a lot of research that says if students don't succeed the first semester, they drop out, or they get so far behind that they're not on track to meet the proficiencies and graduate on time. So it's really to create the system that does all of that. Do you want to add to that?
That's really good description. I mean, again, we tried through this transition team to really think about this as an investment across the continuum, and I think it was incredibly helpful. I mean, with Nancy and Ron Saxon and Mary and I, we talked about this together, thinking, well, how do you design a system that really meets these goals? And again, I would just concur with Nancy. The whole idea is to focus on the learners, focus on the learning outcomes, understand how we're currently spending the dollars, and then using that understanding to figure out how to most strategically invest on the continuum. And I would also stress to look at ways of doing things differently along the continuum where we're spending a lot of money. I mean, another example we highlighted in our report, and I know it's coming in front of you, so raise it. You know, one of the areas for innovation and improvement is the university, taking the university out of state government. We looked at that and concluded, yeah, that would be a way to create some savings and efficiencies and make the universities actually more consistent with the rest of the education enterprise. And again, things like that, when you start looking at the numbers and asking how do we get greater value, I think you'll see a lot of opportunities if we really raise up where the money goes, with what outcomes, to think about ways of doing things differently, which I think really could be sparked by a board that's looking at the whole system, looking at all the dollars and looking at all the outcomes. And I think it's a great opportunity.
Okay, so let's open it up to questions, and I'll ask the first one. You know, one of I completely agree, you know, on the importance of, you know, looking at the education enterprise in a system-wide way. But one of the dangers there, and I brought this up before, is that it lends to a way of thinking of, you know, that students are going to progress in a sort of lockstep manner from, you know, pre-K, you know, all the way up without any kind of interruption. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I look at the real world of education now, certainly at post-secondary education, you know, more and more of the students who are in post-secondary education have been out of it for, and some of them have really been out of it, you know, for a while. And there are just real challenges with the reintegration as they come back into the system. And in a lot of cases, that's where the remediation is needed. And, you know, for many students, just from having been out of school, well, some, you know, just being out of school a summer, you know, let alone a year or two, requires some remediation. So, you know, my concern is, you know, will the system really accommodate them? And are they going to be of secondary importance, those students who have stopped out and are re-entering? And won't we still have to invest significant dollars in bringing them back into, you know, onto course?
Well, I'll take a stab at that if I might. I mean, I totally agree with that need. And again, I think an investment board or any board, certainly our work in higher ed, and I'll touch on this in terms of how we respond to it, the adult learners are hugely important. They will be for, you know, both from relatively low-skilled individuals to people who are going back for a significant professional degree experience. And I think it's very important that we both provide resources for that, and we certainly do today, and also to think carefully about how we deliver services to those. For example, one of the areas where we've been very innovative in Oregon is around the career pathways, where we chunk curriculum, where rather than going to the regular quarter-based system, we have relatively intense curriculum where you can then go back to work, and it's more structured around the needs of an adult learner. I think whether this is not an investment board issue specifically, but I think a policy issue is, are we creating the right incentives to allow learning to happen in the terms of the learner needs in their lives, and the life of an adult learner is very different from a 19-year-old who goes in a traditional college framework. So I think we really do need to be focused on that. In each case, again, looking at the learners, ask what are the outcomes, or do we have the delivery system, and really sharpening our focus. I think a focus on learners would help us do that. It's a critically important service that we provide in the state.
Colleagues. Rip Johnson.
Duncan, I wonder from your perspective with the the business council and so forth, and it getting kind of back to what Rep Lindsay was addressing earlier in the resources that we need but don't currently have access to try to provide for more consistent access for students throughout the system. But I wonder what just if you would weigh in on the concept of public sector support as a means of leveraging private sector investment.
Thanks.
And thoughts you might have and your colleagues sure. might have about that and how that could play a role in where we go from here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Co-Chair Johnson. That's a great question. There are a lot of things to cover in this, and I haven't had a chance to talk about this. One of the areas clearly is around where I would use an example is around technical education and engineering specifically. If you look at what you've done, one of the things we did recommend in the report is targeted investment in the high demand, high critical professions, and again, I would strongly recommend that. And in the case of engineering, where the in the engineering investment the state's made, I believe now it's been about a 2-to-1 match in private sector dollars. And so again, the private sector has really rallied. You've got a private sector driven initiative in the Engineering Technology Council, and again, they've stepped up as part of that. Another example clearly is in healthcare, where I think you're seeing a lot of investment by the healthcare community along with the schools themselves. And I would stress a lot of companies invest directly in on behalf of their workers, paying for the tuition of Oregonian their workers, especially that tends to be more in the larger companies. But again, you're seeing tuition reimbursement programs that try to participate in providing for the education of their folks. In the end of the day, this is a very expensive enterprise, and a lot of it does come with public dollars. And I think arguably we're going to need more public dollars. I hope the growing economy, if we get on the path that we've talked about of getting the economy moving, more money coming in, if we invest it properly, that can get us on a virtuous cycle where we get better educated folks driving the economy forward and we can get on a positive path. We're really concerned that the path we've been on has been moving us in exactly the wrong direction, so we do need to make a turn. And again, why higher ed is so important to the economy and to this whole conversation is because if it drives the economy, drives incomes, that helps bring in more revenue for the state, and so it really is a critical investment right now.
Thanks. I'd like to ask, and Nancy, maybe you could speak to where the governor's thinking is now in terms of the grand design. There's a proposal for the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, which would be part of or under the investment board. Could you kind of walk us through that a little
sure.
bit?
Sure. So the governor's just begun to share. I know he shared with you yesterday and Representative Johnson, and the idea is to start sharing with all legislators kind of the transition from the current system to the final system that we'll see. But in there are sort of coordinating committees at both 05, K-12, and higher ed. And part of that is because although the investment board's looking 0 to 20, there still is lots of work that needs to be done at each of these levels. And so we see that each of these committees, the 05, the K-12, and the higher ed, and in this case, the coordinating committee, can really be at a level of detail that the investment board's not going to be thinking of, because the investment board is really about what are the outcomes, what do we invest in, meaning what are the best practices to get us to the outcomes, and how do we know if we got to those outcomes. So every level still has lots of things to think about, like coordinating services or making sure that you're looking at tuition, and that certainly would be part of the group of the investment board too. But it's just to be able to be at one level more, I don't know if you call it governance or more practical, working on the details that wouldn't happen up there.
Mm-hmm. So just to follow up. So you do see that having some kind of governance role. I mean, and Duncan, you're on the State Board of Education, you know, where you are, you know, every month dealing with governance issues with respect to K-12 and community colleges. Where do you see that work happening? I mean, does that work need to happen, and where does it happen, and by whom, as you envision it
at
this point?
Well, I'm loath to get into the boxes from my point of view at this point. I mean, what I would say, I think the important piece is to talk about what state-level functions you want to take on. And then, I mean, and again, and I've certainly thought about it from my state board hat. And one of the questions on these functions is, to what degree do they cut across the continuum? What I see is a problem of silos that we have. And again, this is no criticism of any of the systems, because, for example, what I'm about to say, there's been incredible work across the silos. It's just really hard. The integration of the high school diploma, curriculum, all the way, you know, from high school into community college into university system, because they're separate entities, the work gets done, and it gets done brilliantly. But it's just a lot harder. So I think, is there a state-level function of assessment, standards, curriculum that you want to make sure is seamless across the system? You need to think about that function and, you know, where that resides, as an example. The budget function, again, we need to have a way of looking at the whole budget across the system. So we need to think of those functions, and then once you've got the functions in mind, then you start putting together, okay, who's reporting to whom and all of those things. So I'm not exactly answering your question, but I am trying to answer it in the way of saying the first step is, what do we want to get done at the state level? How do you organize it? And then I think it'll become clear what the roles of the different boards are. I don't have a... I think it's going to be a work in progress, but I think the idea of having an overarching board that's focused on the whole and looking at the funding allocations for the whole system is absolutely critical for driving education improvement, and I think that's the key idea that I would recommend you look at.
Mm-hmm. And you do see, then, a valuable role for some kind of higher education coordinating commission, then?
Yeah, without getting into the councils and the roles, I can see, I mean, there's clearly got to be a higher ed focus, and some, you know, got to focus on the issues of tuition and all the issues we were talking about earlier. So there, whether it's a council or whoever it is, I'm not so much focused on the box, but there's certainly a lot of work associated with the end of high school, higher ed, community college, and, you know, that group of students, and, you know, I can see the need for a focus, as Nancy said, on those issues by somebody specifically on those issues.
Great, thanks. Colleagues?
Nancy?
Yes, please.
Chair. To the degree that you're able, I wonder if you could kind of share or talk to perhaps the governor's order of importance, let's just say, on legislation that might come out of this session regarding higher ed specifically. What types of things might be phase one? What things could be perhaps phase two? What might be an interim? What might be 3 or 4 years down the road? I don't, to whatever degree you're able to talk about, that would be great.
So I think the thing that's most important now is the creation of the investment board and making sure it has some budgeting authority, because it's all about budgeting to outcomes. I think the other thing the governor has spoken about is, and House Senate Bill 242 speaks to this, is just more autonomy at the higher ed level. I think my sense is there's a consensus around the need for more autonomy. Exactly how that's going to look, we don't know, because we're still in conversation with that. But certainly, like Duncan said, you know, just shifting it a little bit is really important. And so that's what I would say.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so I read between the lines, in perhaps you're saying we have some short-term needs that can be addressed, obviously, that people can agree upon, but this, again, is a continuum. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yes. It's
begin to focus on this P20, 020 concept for the first time, I think, as a governing body in this session, but now we're not going to get all that done, perhaps in one session, but we will make an incremental step to try to get to where Duncan and I think, you know, you realize we need to get, so I appreciate that.
Great, thank you. Rip Parker?
You're reading my mind. I haven't quite put up my hand yet.
I saw it move.
Body language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my questions are around this same area, and I guess we're just going to have to read between the lines here for a while, but we're, as you know, some of us are really wrestling with the different proposals that are before us, and some of them are coming here, some of them may just go straight to Ways and Means over on the Senate side. And I, for one, have a great desire that to try to ensure that what we do is in alignment with, as much as possible, to as great a degree as possible, with what the desires are coming out of all of the brain trust that's been applied to this, and would welcome as much clarity on those desires as soon as such is possible. I might be the only one who feels that.
I think you express a very common desire, Rep. Parker, and you know, just to remind you all, on Thursday we are going to be talking about the the 242 and 2118, and you know, we also have a bill out there that has to do with setting the accountability metrics that are a vital part of this, the performance metrics. And we're going to have extensive conversation about that. Thursday is almost entirely devoted to that. So it would really be great if people could do some more thinking about these issues between now and Thursday. You two, Nancy and Duncan, have really, I think, teed this off very well. And we're going to come back to it, and we will have extensive conversation around it. I for one, am going to be thinking more about your notion that you expressed, Duncan, about kind of, I don't know that you use this word, but sort of task teams, mm-hmm. or, you know, cross-sector task teams, functions, like, yeah. say, related to remediation, mm-hmm. for example, mm-hmm. which is not just an issue, obviously, for higher education. It's something that really crosses the sectors, and perhaps that can be an effective way to be doing things. So can we create a structure that really allows for that?
Yes. Right. I think you can. That's...
Okay, well, one last question.
Yeah, thank you. And maybe this is too much in the boxes, but is the thinking that the investment board is going to have the authority to create budgets for and to fund budgets directly, or is that going to come back to us, make recommendations to the legislature?
Yeah, I believe what that is as the governor prepares his budget, he wants to prepare it based on budgeting to performance outcomes that can reach the goals we all have established and reach. So, like the normal process now, he proposed the budget. You folks are, you know, you'll work your process, and in the end, you'll have a budget. So, but, you know, the hope is if we all can believe in the system as it evolves, we'll all see the importance of getting to these outcomes. And when he presents his budget, it's going to make a whole lot of sense and could be something that makes sense to you, too, as you work through your process.
There's that hope. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, both of you. Thanks, Duncan.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Okay, and with that, I will close this informational meeting on higher education policy, and I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2027, and I will call up Teresa Green to present this bill. This is a continuation of the series of bills that we started on Thursday having to do with career schools. And Teresa, if you could just give us a very quick overview of what this bill tries to do, what the problem is and what it's trying to solve.
Good afternoon. Chair Dambo and members of the committee, thank you for hearing us today. For the record, my name is Teresa Green. I'm a director at the Oregon Department of Education in charge of licensing private career schools, and we're here today in support of House Bill 2027. In our private career school overview last week, we highlighted the legislative intent of the regulation that we provide. First and foremost, our mission is to protect the interests of the student. In the past 2 years, we've increased our attention to the quality and accuracy of the information provided to both enrolled students and potential students about a school's policies, objectives, methods, requirements, outcomes, and costs. There have been too many occurrences of promises made by a school that could not be fulfilled, information not disclosed before a student signed an enrollment agreement, or information that was communicated in a manner that was misleading because the information was incomplete, inaccurate, or both. House Bill 2027 deals with private career school agents. Some schools employ agents to assist them with their recruitment efforts. An agent acts as a salesperson for the school, providing information to potential students as they're making their decision about whether to enroll at a particular school or not. Statute currently defines an agent as a person who's employed by or for a school for the purpose of procuring students by solicitation in any form in places other than the school office or place of business. With the integration of personal computing technology into education, we've seen the internet used as a tool for recruitment in a variety of ways. Primarily they use this as a way of procuring referrals for a school or its agents to follow up with in person. However, a new twist on this activity has emerged, whereby an internet site can be configured to provide information to a student about a school at the same level as provided by a live person, even to the extent of assisting a student in filling out an admissions application and forwarding it to the student's school of choice. This type of activity goes beyond just making referrals and crosses over into the domain of services performed by an agent. While it could be argued that the current definition of agent is sufficient to encompass a person who provides agent services through technological means, House Bill 2027 seeks to add clarification to that definition, thereby acknowledging 21st century realities of how technology is being integrated into daily life. The original version of this bill adds language that specifies a person who's engaged by a school to provide agent services through technological means is considered an agent and should be registered by the school as such with the Department of Education. And we do this so that we're aware of the various means of information dissemination used by the school so that we can ensure that accurate, timely, and complete information is provided to potential students before they commit their time and resources to an institution. The committee should also have our Dash 1 amendment to this bill, as requested by one of our stakeholders, that clarifies that we do not consider websites that are limited to just referral services or that are acting without the permission of the school to be acting as agents. We'd also like to note that we had a productive meeting yesterday with the Oregon State Nursing Board around their efforts to implement student consumer protections in their administrative rules. We anticipate that that rule change process will be completed by the end of June, which will allow the Nursing Board to assume regulation of certain schools. And once that rule change process is complete, institutions and facilities offering only CNA and CMA training will be eligible for exemption from the private career school rules, including House Bill 2027. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Okay, thank you, Teresa. First of all, colleagues, let me tell you that the Dash 1 amendments are being printed right now, copied, so you'll get copies of them. Teresa, I'm very happy to hear that that meeting occurred, and apparently the differences have been worked out, or the clarifications are needed. Maybe not, but we'll, I think, be getting some further testimony about that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone have any questions right now for Teresa, or perhaps we could hear from, we have two people signed up, yes, Joe Greenman and Joel Fisher. So maybe we could hear from you two, and then Teresa, if you could stay, you know, stay close.
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Dembrough, Chair Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher, speaking on behalf of Northwest Career Colleges Federation. I want to thank Teresa Green for doing a great job of explaining the effect of the Dash 1 amendments. And with the Dash 1 amendments, we are in support of the bill.
Thank you, Joe.
Chairman Dembrough, Chairman Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Joe Greenman. I'm legal counsel with Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent over 500 long-term care facilities throughout the state of Oregon. The reason I'm here before you today is because Oregon Healthcare Association, in cooperation and in partnership with an online training company, has developed a course to assist with the training of CNAs using an online format. And House Bill 2027 caught our attention, mainly because upon first reading prior to the Dash 1 amendments, we were under the belief that it would cause our partner and Oregon Healthcare Associations to Oregon Healthcare Association to become a registered agent of the Oregon Department of Education. The Dash 1 amendments, say, are an improvement and a step in the right direction, although the clarifying language of what an agent is not, which is at the very end of the Dash 1 amendment, I believe still does not go far enough. And the reason for that is that our partner in maintaining the web page where consumers can learn about the online training option populates that web page with information about the career schools who purchase the online training product, including information about their admission policies, information about the cost of tuition, other information about the school. They don't do this in exchange for any monetary compensation. They essentially do it so that the consumer can know when they happen to be surfing the internet and find this particular web page, who's a purchaser of this product and how they can get more information about the career school that is a purchaser of the product. And in the event that they would be forced to become an agent because they do that, I think that probably the alternative would be that they would cease doing that. They would take that information off of their web page and leave the consumer, frankly, without that information. They would be basically have to go back to the internet and do more searching. And I think that that's actually some of the things that Oregon Department of Education is trying to deal with because of those sort of online recruitment entities that are trying to basically, for a fee or for a referral, get somebody to go to a particular career school, whereas we're just providing a piece of information about which career school is a purchaser of our online training product, and we'd like our partner to be able to continue to do that.
Mm-hmm. So just to clarify, so you're saying that in this case, what we're talking about is not an agent, but more just an information clearinghouse. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And information about all the career schools who have been approved by Oregon State Board of Nursing to offer a CNA training with the use of our online classroom portion of the CNA training program.
Great. Thank you. Teresa, could you come back up? Thanks. Actually, if you Joe, you can. Thank you, Joel. Joe, why don't you stay?
Sure.
Yeah, but so.
Teresa, first, Rep Springer had a question, and then maybe we'll go to the point that Joe just made. Go ahead.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for indulging me. And Teresa, thank you for coming back up. I appreciate that. So I started thinking about these comments after you stepped down. You talked about some concerns that there have been with schools, and certainly from up here we've heard those comments before on different entities. But we also need to be very careful when we make those kinds of statements. So I'd like to hear maybe an example or two very recently of some of those concerns.
Sure. Chair Dembrough, Representative Springer, thank you for the question. Recently there was a career college in Portland that had a class action suit brought against them because the information that they put out about the salary students could expect upon graduation was unrealistic, could be attained really only in the most ideal of conditions, and the tuition that they were charging didn't justify the salary that students were actually being able to command when they got out. And so they rose up in protest, as they should, and brought a class action suit against the school. I will say that most of our schools don't employ an agent. They give the information directly, but we monitor all the different ways that schools disseminate their information to try and prevent situations like that from happening. I can think of at least three schools off the top of my head right now that have been involved in civil litigation because students felt that they had been misled by the information that was provided to them. And that's not to say that the school is always at fault. You know, sometimes a student doesn't understand the information. But we do work with the schools whenever we see something that we feel is misleading to clarify it and make it understandable at
I call it the preschool level, you know, so that there is really very little room for misunderstanding.
So just to follow up, Teresa, to Rep. Springer's question, so was the problem here that the department could not go after the school because they distanced themselves from what the agent or the person providing the information was saying? And you want to create a closer line of responsibility? Is that what you're trying to do here?
Chair Dimbrough, I'm sorry, I don't quite understand what you're asking. Are you asking in reference to the school in Portland?
Or yes, to this situation. How exactly does this bill fix that problem?
Agents are one of the ways that schools disseminate their information. You know, we require the schools to provide to us their advertising, provide us with the URL for any website that they use. We look at their brochures, their school catalogs, and what we're looking for is to make sure that the claims they are making are supported by data, are consistent with other statements being made by other schools in the industry. You know, everything has to kind of be reasonable. If it's not, then we ask them to provide justification for what they're doing. Sometimes they don't understand that responsibility themselves, and then we help them with that, and they modify things so that it is in compliance. So,
yeah. Okay, let's let Rep. Springer follow up on that, and then Rep. Lindsay has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the department deals with schools, correct?
Yes.
Thank you. Well, so then I'm wondering why we need to change the language to agent, because you're not dealing with individuals, you're dealing with schools. And if somebody's representing a school, whether their paycheck is cut by that school or as an employee or a contractor, I'm not yet putting together the pieces why we need the language change since the department deals with schools. Am I missing something there?
Chair Dimbrough, Representative Springer, we deal with schools and we hold the school responsible for the actions of their agents.
Right.
And so we have guidelines set out in administrative rule corresponding to the statute to help the schools know what our expectation is around dealing with their agents. Their agents have to be trained in the school's policies. They have to, and it's all to ensure that the agents are giving good information. Another example I could give you would be with the modeling school that we've been working with. You know, the industry of modeling is one that students come to with stars in their eyes, and we have had a lot of complaints on that school because the students felt like they were misled coming into it, that they were going to, you know, get this training and be able to go out and get this job and be famous and blah, 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 and it doesn't work out that way. So we've sat down and talked with the school and looked at how they were presenting their information, and we could see where it would be a bit misleading. And so we advised them in ways to change that. And one comment that they made was that, well, some of this is coming from our agents. And we said, well, you need to talk with your agents and have them present this information in a different way, because these are the complaints that we're getting. And they need to know going in, before they sign that paper, that there is no guarantee that they're going to be famous, that most people don't get a job in this industry.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me with one more follow-up.
Okay, one more.
Thank you. Has there been an instance where, because of the lack of language that's proposed here, the department hasn't been able to do something that the department felt it needed to do?
Chair Dimbrough, Representative Springer, I wouldn't characterize it quite that way. As I said in my testimony, you can argue that the language is sufficient, but what happens is we will say to someone, well, this isn't going to work, you need to do it this way, and then they push back on us. And we say, well, you know, it really is this way, and they don't like it, and they say, well, where is it in the statute? Where is it in the rule? And, you know, sometimes it just gets to be messy. So what we've tried to do in all of the revisions that we've made to our administrative rules is to clarify things and make it very clear what our expectations are, so that we can be proactive in preventing some of those conversations. And
right. So the purpose of this bill is to just make it clear that an agent is not just a person in a face-to-face kind of relationship, right?
Chair Dembo, correct.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
Rep. Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you can tell, my gym, they misled me because I thought I was going to be a lot bigger than I am. So this, first of all, you know that, I think we should all know that public schools are also being sued right now, class action for, I was going to get paid a lot more than I got paid when I graduated, and that's a good idea. Maybe I ought to think about going after my public school for the money that they promised I was going to get. We can spend hours on that, but the question is, isn't it true that a system is already in place to solve this? Isn't this just duplicative? I mean, we have UTPA claims, we have class action claims. The system's working. Isn't this just duplicative?
Chair Dembo, Representative Lindsay, I can see that how you might see that. I don't know that I would say it's duplicative. There are a lot of nuances in the work that we do, and agents are a piece of the advertising piece, and the language that we have in the rule about UTPA is directed more towards the owner of the school, whom we hold responsible. So in a roundabout way, we could make that work. I guess we just prefer to have real clear, direct guidance set out in the statutes and the rules.
Presumably, Teresa, you could handle this matter through rule, right? I mean, the key is that the schools know what the expectations are, right? The department has an expectation that that information about the school that is presented by the school, either directly or through an agent, whether that's a person or electronically, is going to be accurate and reflects the, you know, the responsibility of the school. So that can be done through statute, which would perhaps give it an additional sort of hammer, but it could also be clearly expressed through rule, couldn't it?
Well, Chair Dembo, there's a definition in statute of what an agent is, and people get hung up on the fact that it says a person.
Okay.
And so it's that piece that we're trying to clarify, that it is a person, but it can be more than just a person face-to-face.
Thank you. Joe, do you have anything to add, just to kind of summarize your position on,
sure,
what you would like us to do with this?
Yes, Chairman Dembro. To the last point that Teresa made, actually I think that everything in 1A, capital A, of 2027 gets to that changing the terminology from a person to an individual, and I think that that's well taken language and probably important from her perspective to clarify that piece, that it's not only an individual human being person, but an individual, which could then also be clarified as an entity. In terms of Oregon Healthcare's perspective, I have taken the time to draft an alternative 1B on that portion to their -1 amendment that talks about what an agent is not. That doesn't quite get to where we need to get in order to avoid our partner from having to become a registered agent. And so I drafted some language. I'd be happy to share it with the committee at your request to try and get at that. And I have provided it to Teresa and some others who represent the Oregon Department of Education as well.
We'd be happy to look at it, I'm sure. Teresa, do you have any problems with that language just ahead of time?
Chair Dembo, yes, we do, because the language that they are proposing, the definition of an agent then hinges on whether or not there's monetary compensation for the service. And we don't care whether the school is paying the agent or not. They're still providing information, and that information still has to be true and accurate and timely. So the issue of compensation is irrelevant from our perspective.
Well, it looks like we may still have some work to do then, and perhaps, Anna, we could talk about further little work group to try to get that resolved. Colleagues, any? Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Just one question, more of a comment, but I guess as I think about our institutions of higher education, I think many of them, or most of them, likely make some sort of claims or assertions perhaps about the percentage of their graduates in their law school program that, you know, are placed in certain types of positions or whatever, whether it be what percentage of our bachelor degrees go on to achieve whatever. But I just wonder where we would draw the line on what is, you know, intended to mislead, or what is just simply information that's thrown out there based on past practices, but it may not apply to you. You know, there's no guarantee this is going to apply to you. So I guess for me it kind of opens up kind of a gray area in that. So that's just kind of where I am in thinking about that. And Rep. Hoyle has a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Rep. Hoyle.
So the issue you're trying to, there's certain situations that I've seen, and again, they're very narrow, and it is a specific group of institutions that are less mainstream where the claims are really out of proportion with what is an actual reality for what someone could expect. I think a modeling school is a great example. I mean, I don't care how long I went to school, I'm not going to be a high fashion model. It's just not going to happen. But again, if somebody is just trying to fill the roles, then, you know, there's marketing, and then there's the point where it comes out to something that's just not actually true or real. So is that what you're trying to get at? Is something that's particularly egregious? Or, I mean, how do we help people feel comfortable with that gray area from X number of students are become lawyers who make, you know, millions of dollars, you know, and we don't want people bringing lawsuits saying, well, how come I'm not making millions, to something that is absolutely egregious? I mean, is there a way to help people feel comfortable with that?
Chair Denver, Representative Hoyle, I think so. You know, part of our monitoring process, we do require the schools to submit to us their analysis of the labor market and to base their information that they're providing to the students on that data. And we've just recently passed some rules so that data has to be recent. It can't be, you know, 10 years old. It's got to be within the last 3 years. And then they need to keep it updated so that the student is always getting current, accurate information.
Mm-hmm. Presumably, the department would have to make its case, right? Mm-hmm. And in some cases, that would become a contested case that the department would have to prevail on. So just being able to do it is not in and of itself a guarantee of success, right?
Chair Dembro, yes. You know, any sanction that we take against a school has to come with an opportunity for a hearing, and then we make our case. And so in working with our AG over the last couple of years, you know, they've really stressed to us the importance of having things very clearly outlined in statute so that our line of authority is clear. Because if we go into hearing, we want to have solid footing.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, if there are no other questions, I'm going to bring this hearing to an end, and we will probably be seeing you again. So thank you both. So, and with that, I'm going to bring this public hearing on House Bill 2027 to an end. And anyone have any questions? Go to the order. Thursday, OUS, higher ed in general, be ready. Come with your questions. See you then. Meeting adjourned.